Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio show that unveils the secret twists and turns behind real career stories. Making the world a better place. That's what so many people say is what they want to do. But what kind of better place? What do people really mean by that? Today's Career Buzz guests make the world a better place, though in very different ways. Yet making that difference is what's at the heart of what today's guests do. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, president and practice leader of the career-defining firm CareerCycles.com. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thank you for tuning in. Toby Yell makes the world a better place one home at a time. Her sweet spot is the place where interior design and living consciously collide. After graduating from Fanshawe College's School of Design, Toby launched her own interior design firm. She's helped hundreds of clients design their dream homes from the ground up. Starting in 1990, Toby was a regular columnist with the Hamilton Spectator, where she shared her thoughts on design and life. Toby joins us in the second half hour of Career Buzz today. But first, Annette Ittig works toward making the world a better place in some of the highest conflict zones in the world. Dr. Annette Ittig is an evaluation and livelihood specialist working in emergency response and international development. She's undertaken missions in Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia for donors, UN agencies, and NGOs, including CEDA, the World Bank, United Nations Human Settlements Program, and the United Nations Development Program. She received her undergraduate degree right here from the University of Toronto and her doctorate from the University of Oxford. Annette Ittig joins me live in our Toronto studio. Welcome to Career Buzz, Annette.
Hi, good morning, Mark. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us here this morning.
Thank you.
I know you're just here in Toronto for a brief time between international stops. Great to have you and talk to you about your career. What do you like about your career these days?
A lot of things, but, you know, I'm not so sure. There are days when I'm not so sure that it's all about making the world a better place. I really like the hands-on aspect of being in the field, interacting directly with the people who are the clients or the beneficiaries in aid speak. And through, excuse me, what I do, the monitoring and evaluation, the assessments, I have direct input into the policymakers and decision makers who may or may not listen to my field observations and assessments of their program. So I feel that within the aid world, I've got a really nice niche.
And what kinds of things are you doing? If I know you've recently come back from Afghanistan. Can you just give us a flavor for a recent project, maybe the most recent one, to give listeners a sense of what's actually happening in these places that you're working?
Well, normally I'm contracted either by, or most frequently by, one of the UN agencies. I'm on several different rosters. And if I were to take something like a typical monitoring and evaluation experience, let's say Uganda, where I was, okay. Where I was last year, that was a mission for United Nations Development Program, and they had heard about me because I'm on their roster, and they go through the roster and they see, oh, this person has this, that, and the other experience, this linguistic ability, so and so. And my particular task was to go into the field to do a number of site evaluations to see if the planned project, which in this case was linked to livelihoods and the reintegration of internally displaced people and people who might have gone out as a result of conflict with, you know, Lord's Resistance Army, that
this
kind of thing.
This was in northern Uganda where
yes,
that was happening, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. We did several assessments, Karamoja, northern Uganda, Gulu, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, often these things are really condensed into a few weeks of going from site to site, and there's not always a lot of wiggle room in case something happens. Oh, my goodness, there's a flood, or the plane needs a part, or whatever, which kind of adds, I mean, it gets the adrenaline going, definitely. So for these kinds of things, you go out and it's formulaic. You interview key stakeholders, yes. key informants, who would be donor representatives, for example, the CETA representative, the DFID representative. You would, of course, interview key agency staff, in this case within UNDP and other UN agencies, for example, UNHCR, the refugee agency. And then you go to the field and you interview not only the heads of the offices, the local offices, but you actually go and if you're thorough and you have the time, you must interview the actual clients, the beneficiaries. So in this case, it meant going to a couple of IDP camps and actually meeting with the young men and women who were the recipients of the aid for livelihood, vocational training, etc.
IDP is displaced persons?
Internally displaced person. So they're no longer in their place of origin or their usual home, but they're within the boundaries of their country. A refugee is somebody who is no longer within their home country. They're in another country. For example, if they're Afghan, they're now in Pakistan or Iran. As opposed to being, let's say, in Kabul, as opposed to Mazar, so that it's another country. They're a refugee.
Now, how does this career, what you're doing, this kind of almost parachuting into a place, working for a brief period of time, and then moving on to something completely different, how does that draw on your strengths? How does that fit who you are as a person?
I should say that my degree and actually even my undergraduate and my master's degree were what one could call area studies. I'm not sure they do that anymore, but I have my degree in Oriental Studies, for example, from Oxford, and what that entails is language, history, culture, socioeconomic background about a region. So you become not an expert, but you become informed about the various different layers of how a society works and interacts within itself and with other societies. I myself have quite strong writing and presentation skills, and I'm very analytical. And these are all strengths when one is doing monitoring and evaluation. I'm detailed-oriented, and I enjoy looking at a situation and seeing how it works, how it doesn't work, what it was supposed to do, how it could do that better.
So it does draw on some skills that you feel you actually possess, and then others that you develop through the course of your education.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's step back in time. There may be listeners thinking, wow, that sounds like a great job. I'd like to do international development. I know I worked at the University of Toronto as a career counselor and spoke to many students and recent grads and master's students who sincerely wanted to help make the world a better place on an international mm-hmm. level. And there may be listeners who are saying, well, no, she has an interesting career. How did she get there? So could we step back in time and just understand how all of this happened? Could you start us off by what you did here at the University of Toronto to begin with? What did you study after high school?
I started off here in a program that I don't think they have anymore called sociology and philosophy, which was, you know, slack and fail. And that was a four-year program, but I went into history. And I've always been fascinated by other parts of the world and especially archaeology. I mean, as a kid, I can remember going to the museum and just thinking, oh, wow, the Greek and Roman stuff. Oh, yeah, archaeology. Wouldn't that be fantastic, you know, to do? And from my undergraduate, I went into graduate studies here in what was then Middle East and Islamic Studies with a museology link to it. And I was really fortunate. I had an opportunity to go as part of that program to Iran.
Wow.
Yeah.
As a graduate student, a master's student.
Well, I was doing the Middle East and Museum Studies degree. And it was fantastic. I mean, I worked in the Decorative Arts Museum in Tehran, and I got to catalog the folk paintings, and I got to do field work in different parts of the countries. I lived with the British Institute of Persian Studies and archaeological group, and you know, it was started by Max Mallowan, Agatha Christie's husband.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. So, and everybody went through there. Everybody. It was fantastic. And when I finished that, I wasn't really sure, you know, what would I do next? And
had you been thinking up until that point What am I going to do with this, especially in like these areas of study that aren't specific, like engineering or dentistry? You know, you were studying history and then the Near East or the Middle East. You know, lots of students and recent grads also have interests like that. And then there's this big question that emerges in their mind. Well, what am I going to do with all of that? As if, you know, if I study history, I need to be a historian. And there's this kind of oversimplification, I think, in the minds of many people about an area of study and then the corresponding world of work.
How do you pay the rent?
Yeah. Now, where were you at before the story unfolds and you actually start working? Did you have thoughts in mind during the undergrad and then at the beginning of the master's degree, saying to yourself, oh, well, here's how this all unfolds. Here's where I'm going to go with this.
Well, actually, between my the completion of my undergrad and starting my master's degree, I had a couple of years off, and I had a, you know, I worked for a an investment house in New York for a year, made enough money to live for 2 years. And the guy I was seeing at the time wanted to go off and work on a dig in Israel. I wanted to go to Egypt. Anyway, we ended up being in Israel. So I worked on a couple of digs in Israel and mended pottery. I mean, it's a pretty low-level job, but it was great.
And but you got experience.
I got experience.
It cemented your interest in the field as opposed to just leaving it in an academic kind of theoretical phase.
Yeah, but Mark, you know, I did it as a volunteer. And what I got in exchange was kind of room and board at one of the digs. And when I came back a year later to Toronto, I really wanted to work at the museum. I really wanted to do something. And of course, you know, you need to have much higher degrees than what I had to do anything specialist. And I ended up having a short contract to do a little blurb for the discovery room. And I ended up with a job in the Board of Trustees office as the secretary
at the museum.
At the museum. Yeah, the secretary to the secretary of the board. And I learned a lot. I hadn't been exposed to that kind of, you know, the administrative side,
the
infrastructure things that go on in a museum. And as I was doing that, you know, this museum studies program was brought to my attention. I think at that time it was new. And I thought, I'm going to do that.
The museum studies program.
Yeah,
so one thing led to another.
Yeah.
It was actually all these different experiences leading to sort of like clues, you know, little breadcrumbs of clues leading you to the next thing so that you knew, yeah, maybe the museum studies is the thing I should do next.
Well, but I really wanted to do that. I mean, yeah. I could have gone to law school.
Yeah.
Which would have made my parents very happy. Or done dentistry. But I didn't want to, and the world was a little bit of a different place at that time. There seemed to be so many more things that one could do, and there wasn't quite the same pressure. I mean, we weren't in an economic recession,
for example.
Yeah. So I went into museum studies, and from there, you know, through a contact of one of my professors, ended up in Tehran.
So you did this. You did this experiential component of your education, really, in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
What happened next? How did that then turn into the doctorate degree at Oxford?
I went from the Decorative Arts Museum to the Carpet Museum again through a contact of a friend of a friend, and they had a revolution in Iran. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? Can't stay here. And through the British Institute, I was put in touch with friends of friends and colleagues of colleagues in London and Oxford. And one of the professors there said, hey, I really like what you've done, you know, could you do something on the carpet industry for another degree? And I thought, oh, well, where am I going to get the money? And I was able to get a couple of grants and scholarships, and that's how I ended up in Oxford.
Amazing. We're talking to Annette Ittig here on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. So Annette, first of all, the doctorate degree doesn't happen overnight. That takes a while. Were you studying and doing fieldwork at the same time? How did that degree unfold for you?
I did fieldwork in a number of different places. It was difficult to work in Iran at that time. I went to Egypt and did work in Cairo. But I finished, when I finished, you know, there weren't a lot of museum jobs. And I ended up on that. I think a lot of people, graduate students, end up doing this sort of part-time teaching, part-time museum, part-time lecturing, this and this and this. And as much as I love that world and I met fantastic people and I had the privilege to work with incredibly beautiful objects as well, and carpet collectors, it wasn't really enough to pay. It was enough to pay the rent, but not to do much more.
Yes.
And I thought, how am I going to, you know, I know this part of the world. What can I do? And there had been an earthquake in Iran. And a friend of mine said, listen, I understand that, you know, the Canadian Red Cross is you know, going to be sending people there. Why don't you go and speak to the Red Cross people and see maybe there's something you can do because you know that part of the world and you know the language. And I went to Canadian Red Cross and I met the guy who was in charge of volunteers.
This was in London at the time?
No, it was here.
It was in Toronto.
Toronto. And he said, listen, you know, if you're going to be going to Iran, we would really like to get some footage of the earthquake. And, you know, we're looking to make contact with, you know, whoever might be the responsible people at Iranian Red Crescent and this and this and this. And I ended up going as a volunteer. I linked it into a conference. I was speaking at a carpet conference. I linked it into that, so I had my way paid.
Yes.
And I made contact with the Red Crescent there and got the TV footage and got the names of the contacts, made some very good friends, and came back. And then there were opportunities, not that they paid very much, to do other things. From there, I ended up, again, almost as a volunteer, organizing a peace-building event with foreign affairs funding in Ottawa on Afghanistan. And from there, I went to Afghanistan, and the rest is history.
So this is the origin of your career as an international development specialist. And it was kind of, it's interesting. I mean, there's a little bit of serendipity there, and there's a little bit of planfulness. Like the earthquake in Iran, it just happened. But it was this combination of things that transpired to move your career in this direction. And it sounds like you hadn't really even anticipated what your career might have been post the doctoral degree.
It probably took about, you know, 3-4 years when I realized, gee, you know, it's a small world, you know, for university teaching, and especially in, you know, North America, there really won't be a lot of jobs that come up, and I don't want to be doing these part-time things forever. What can I do? What are my transferable skills?
So you asked yourself that even when, like, let's say we have doctoral candidates listening to us now who are thinking to themselves, well, I can do an academic job search and maybe I'll find a job teaching and researching at a university or an institution. And that's where people, I think, often think. And then they have this kind of amorphous thought, well, hang on, what about non-academic opportunities? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you were open to both, and it was more the economic conditions or the job market that dictated your direction more than, yeah, I don't know, more than a strong desire one way or the other.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, there were, you know, livelihood issues.
Yes.
But there were also, having been in the academic world for many, many years, I also know that I enjoy hands-on. I enjoy field work more than I enjoy sitting in front of a computer all day. I'm not really happy doing that. Although, of course, I have to do that for a certain part of my work. I write reports. I have to contact people. So it serendipitous, yes, but, you know, you make your own luck.
Yes, totally. And it sounds like that was part of it there. Even if you hadn't had the road cleared for you into that career path, you did make your own luck in that way. And things led from one to another with these first couple of contracts.
Well, but, you know, it wasn't that easy. I had gone to a couple of my former professors and said, listen, I'm thinking about, because of the situation, I'm, you know, not having a full-time job, I'm thinking about doing something like international development work. Maybe, if not in Iran, someplace else where I can use my Persian language skills, you know, Afghanistan. And they just said, Afghanistan, well, you know, Annette, no, I mean, that's not really for, you know, like, nice girls don't do that.
Yes, yes.
And I thought, oh, please. So I decided that I would go and I would find whatever way I could get into it. And I realized that because I didn't have years and years of aid experience, the best way for me to get into it would be starting off with volunteer work, which I guess a lot of people do.
Now, how did friends and family react? That is such a big question for people thinking about their next steps in their career. And what do my parents think, or what do everybody in my life think? It's a little out there to say I'm going to go and do international work in places like Iran and Afghanistan. How did people react?
Well, I mean, I'd already been doing museum or cultural heritage work in Iran and other places. So I don't think it was such a big shock. I mean, it's more when people meet me for the first time, or they meet me here in Canada, and, you know, I'm not in the field, I'm not wearing my field clothes, I'm just like a normal, just as like anybody else. They say, "You do what? Wow, like, aren't you scared?" And I have to say, no, I'm adventurous, but I'm not foolish.
Right. And it sounds like it really builds on who you are. You're adventurous, and you know that you're much more of a hands-on, in-the-world person than you are in the...
An ivory tower person.
And so this is a way that you're manifesting in the world who you are.
And you don't always see the impacts of what you do. I guess in that way it is like teaching, and that is development and reconstruction work. It may take years to see, is a particular job creation scheme working?
Yes.
You know, are the kids that are enrolled in this school actually going to become literate? I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. And one of the great things is when you go back to a place, I was walking around in Kabul, I had a contract there and with CETA actually in 2003, 2004. A woman came up to me in the place where I was working, the ministry I was working, and she said, "Annette, how are you?" An Afghan lady. And I said, "Fine, fine." She said, and I had met her 5 years before in a different part of Afghanistan and set up a micro-enterprise scheme for these women with their male relatives because of the cultural thing that is appropriate. And going from sort of 20, 22 women who were trained, they now had a couple of hundred who were involved in different kinds of things and they were earning a living. And she said, "You know, we have your picture up on the wall." And I was like, I was so touched because I hadn't been back there. I didn't know what happened. And I just felt, wow, this is why I want to do this work.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that story. I mean, that is making the world a better place. And it's not so easy to say that the effects are there. And then there's at least an illustration that it had an impact.
Well, thank you. I mean, but it takes time. There's no magic wand. It's not like going in and saying, "Hey, we're going to, you know, change the way. We're going to wipe out cholera, for example," or, you know. It takes time.
So can you give us a kind of a snapshot? I wish we had hours to talk about all the things that you've done, because I know there's been 20 or 30 different international development contracts that you've had. Can you give us some kind of summary or overview of how things transpired after those first few contracts you told us about a few minutes ago through to the present moment? There's just been so many different things. What happened in your career over these years of international development work?
Well, of course, if you're on the ground, if you're in the field and you're interacting not only with the agency that has employed you, but with other kinds of stakeholders, for example, with donor representatives, UN representatives, because I started out with, you know, NGOs.
Yes.
People know you, and any part of these kind of contracts involves, at the end, a presentation to stakeholders. So you get up and you say, "This is what we found." You do your PowerPoint, and you say, "You know, this part of the program is great. It should be replicated. This part, you know, could be stronger." And it was by actually being in the field and meeting people, and in these situations, the aid community is normally, I mean, in Afghanistan today, no, the aid community is not small, but prior to this current situation, in the pre-Karzai days and Taliban times when I was working there, it's a small group of people.
Yes.
And they tend to be very dedicated, and there's a sense of camaraderie, and, you know, sure, there's always, you know, there will be difficult people, it's a stressful place. But, you know, I have friends that I could rely on from that time, and I just feel that no matter what happened, they would be there for me and I would be there for them.
So it sounds like much of what transpired was through your network, through the people that you met and knew, even if it was moving from one country to another?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you zero in on one or two projects that you did that might, again, illustrate the kinds of work that you're doing or the kinds of situations that you face?
Let's see, Somalia. I was in Somalia 2 years ago for the United Nations Development Program, and I had been brought in as an interim program manager, their current program manager for this returnee IDP program was ill. And I had a staff of some 12, 14 people, and it's very challenging to do what's called cross-border programming. Because of the situation in Somalia, the UN doesn't actually have a headquarters in Somalia. They have a headquarters in Nairobi.
Yes.
So you work from, you know, the headquarter people are in Nairobi, and the field people, of course, are in the field. And often in these things, there are misconceptions about what kinds of programs will work, because of course it's like sitting in Geneva and putting together something that you think is going to work in Yemen.
Right. Totally different culture, totally different expectations, different needs.
Yeah. But it can sound fantastic on paper.
Right.
You know? But in reality, it's got to be tweaked a lot, or you have to go back and say, listen, you know, we're going to have a problem with this, or it's going to cost twice as much because the women have to have escorts to go to the school, and, you know, you've got to pay the escorts and blah, blah, blah. One of the things that we did there, Hargeisa is the place where we were mostly, and Hargeisa had huge IDP camps and plastic everywhere. And really, I mean, it's not like here where somebody goes around and picks up the plastic bags. And we were trying to think of some way that we could put, you know, the women to work. And so they could have some kind of income, and, you know, there would also be positive impacts around. And one of my team, and I had I've almost always had fantastic national teams, said, you know, Annette, there's a guy here who's got a little plastic recycling factory.
Yes.
And it's not big, but, you know, maybe he would be willing, you know, we could set up a micro enterprise or a microfinance program for him to buy more equipment, and we could have the women bring this stuff in. We went to talk to him, and he was really keen, and, you know, so that kind of thing, whereby you can get the women out, and there, in this case, there wasn't really a problem with them and their kids going collecting plastic bags, and the idea was they would be paid by weight, and some of the guys from the camp would be trained in how to operate the equipment in the plant, and the guy who owned the plant would be happy because he'd be able to, you know, make more plastic flip-flops, send them to Gulf countries, whatever. So things like that, that's a livelihood. But, you know, the monitoring and evaluation is, as I told you, you go in, and the advantage is because I've worked in the Middle East a lot, I'm familiar with the context. So it's not like shooting in somebody who's just come from New Jersey and never been there before.
Yeah, no, it illustrates that you really need to be there and see what's going on to make something effective. The story of the plastic recycling guy, that's really interesting. What happened with that? If it was a displaced person camp, I mean, that sounds like a kind of temporary thing. What happened with it?
Alas, Mark, the IDP camps are often not temporary. They often go on longer than one expects. I'm not sure what the status is now, because I'm no longer involved with that program, and I'm only really in touch with one of the staff from it who's now in a different location. So I don't know. I would hope that he's gone on to, you know, make lots of flip-flops, and they've got, you know, a lot of people who have benefited out of it.
Now, we just have a couple more minutes left. Two final questions. First, for listeners who are interested in getting into international development, maybe they have an undergrad degree, maybe they have a master's degree. There's a lot of people doing international relations degrees in the universities around Canada and here in Toronto. Any tips, advice, or thoughts on that for them to move their career into this world of international development?
We got to think outside the box. I mean, it's not just NGOs and UN agencies. And I know that there's a program here in international development. I'm sure anyone who's taken that course has been advised to look on, you know, the UN sites and the Relief website. Relief Web actually is a very, very good source for learning about countries, different sectors of work, updates on different kinds of emergencies, whether it's earthquake, hurricane, whatever.
That's Relief Web?
Relief Web.
Is it reliefweb.org or something?
.net.
Reliefweb.net?
Yeah, all one word, .net. Or aidworkersnet, again, that's all one word, .net. But if you think there are lots of other actors besides NGOs or UN people involved in the aid business, foreign affairs. who decides which countries we're going to go to or who we're going to support. There's often a very strong link to foreign policy.
Right.
And there are, you know, so we have DFAT, for example, or we have foreign trade, or we have people who have backgrounds. I mean, of course, it's more straightforward if you have a medical degree or an engineering degree or whatever. There's always a need for professionals, especially if you're willing to go as a volunteer.
Which was the way your career really unfolded, with some volunteer gigs at the beginning.
Yeah.
So people should be open to those kind of volunteer opportunities.
Absolutely.
To start things off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it's not like just going to Mexico. There are other stresses involved, and I think most agencies would not take somebody who hadn't been outside the country doing something like this,
at
even
least,
as a volunteer,
at least once.
For
yeah.
a conflict zone or even a development zone.
Final question, based on your personal experience of your own career and life, what have you learned about making career and life choices?
What have I learned about making career and life choices? I believe that we have gut feelings or intuitions or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And if your gut feeling is, this isn't right for me, this isn't working out, this is not what I want to do, I'm not comfortable doing this, I like doing X, why don't I see if I can do that? I've known too many people, especially people, for example, my parents' age, who got into jobs and they stayed with those jobs like 40 years and they were fantastic providers and they felt, I can't do anything else, I've got to provide for my family. But you know, before you have the family, you've got to be able to provide for yourself.
Yes. So tune into those intuitions and gut feelings. If it feels good, go with it. If it doesn't feel good, take note.
Yeah.
Do something about it.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Annette Ittig, thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, we have a song selected by our next guest, Toby Yal. She thought it would be great to listen to Joni Mitchell with Both Sides Now as a message around career and career choices and looking at things from all sides. Here's Joni Mitchell.
Joni Mitchell. Rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and fairies wheel, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show, and you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, still somehow.
CIUT can now be heard on channel 946 through Rogers Digital Cable.
Like what you're hearing and want more of it? Check out our schedule at CIUT.fm. We have over 80 unique programs we're sure you'll love. We're listener supported. CIUT 89.5 FM.
We're back at Career Buzz, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to our next interview, I just want to let listeners know Career Cycles is hosting the Who You Are Matters Career and Life Clarification Game. Think about it like a career checkup. Come on out for a fun and substantive experience. That's Tuesday, January 13th at 6:30 p.m. at Orange Hippo, 751 Broadview. For more info, check careercycles.com or email me at mark@careercycles.com and tell me one thing you like about your career, anything, and I'll draw one name for free. Saves you $30. It's mark@careercycles.com. Toby Yell's Sweet Spot is the place where interior design and living consciously collide. After graduating from Fanshawe College, Toby launched her own interior design firm. She's helped hundreds of clients design their dream homes from the ground up. Since 1990, Toby was writing for the Hamilton Spectator, where she shared her thoughts on design and life. Toby's led sold-out workshops at the Dundas Valley School of Art and is a frequent guest speaker for schools, charities, and women's groups. Toby Yell joins me live by telephone from her office in Dundas, Ontario. Welcome, Toby.
Good morning, Mark. Nice to be here.
Thanks. Now, what do you like about your career doing the interior design work?
Boy, it is so much I love about it. It's a real privilege to probably, this would be the top thing, it's a real privilege to be invited into people's lives when you are consulting on their homes. You are right in there. You're in their bedroom, their bathroom. You get to know how they live. And I guess I have a lot of curiosity about people. I come home probably every night and say to my husband, wow, I just met the most wonderful family today, or somebody really interesting, or this person knows that person. So I find that aspect is a real delight, and it never ends. It's always new people and always new houses. So I can't imagine getting tired of it. And I've been at it for 24 years.
Wow. And what are you doing now? It sounds like you do the design work, but you also run a small business. So what does a typical week look like for you?
I'll be meeting, let's say going forward into January, or let's look back just at the year we just finished. One major project that carried me through about 9 months, starting in May, finishing in December, was the construction of a new house from the ground up. And I do a lot of that. I probably have done hundreds of those over the years. But in that scenario, I'm meeting weekly with usually the wife, sometimes, both halves of the couple, but meeting every week to make all the selections that go into the finished home. So I'm sort of the go-between between the builder and all of his needs and his sub-trades and the family and, people who've never built a house have never built a house. They don't know what's involved. So it's a great big learning curve, and I'm there to hold their hand and pull them through and get it organized and listen to what they need and want and find the materials and coordinate that all together. So it's a big sorting project. And then I have follow-up, in any regular week, I have follow-up with existing clients that I've already been working with. I have people who call me back after 2 or 3 years and say, Junior is now going to college and we have a spare bedroom, or, baby's out of the crib and into the big bed.
Yes.
So families keep changing. I have 3 generations of some families where I've worked with grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and then their grown-up children.
That's great.
A real privilege, too.
So you've had some really good word-of-mouth referrals from one generation to the next.
Yeah, definitely.
What kind of skills and strengths does this career draw on from you?
Well, I would have to say communication is A1. You can learn the design aspect. I think you do need an affinity, and I do have that. But I think it's the joy of helping people understand something that I have, and that was always my motivation in writing about design, was to make it more accessible, and because I think design has a terrible, terrible rep. People think designers are going to be really snotty, and nobody's going to measure up, and oh God, I can't have you over to my house, you'll laugh at my feeble attempts. There's sort of a very elitist
people,
thing around design.
As if clients are intimidated almost.
Oh yeah, people are terrified. And so I think I've really, in the 24 years and in all the writing I did and in all the consulting and meeting with people that I do, I think job one for me is to reassure them that, okay, I have a house too. I got dog hair on my sofa. You know, my kitchen was a mess when I left the house this morning. So, you know, don't be stressed. We all have a house. And it's not rocket science. It's not some secret arcane thing. It's just getting along with your house and making it be as valuable to you as it possibly can. As in, you're paying for it every day of the year. And if you've got rooms that have sort of like an invisible rope across the door, oh, don't go in there. Don't relax in here. You know, you're wasting a lot of money and enjoyment that you could be having in your home.
Now, how do you feel about the way that you are making the world a better place?
Well, I'm reassured of that every time I have a client meeting. I have had clients literally hug me or cry in my arms at the end of a consult. Many times my work follows on a life change. Someone has been divorced or someone has gotten married or there's been a new baby or a baby left the nest. You know, sometimes there's death. Sometimes, you know, there's grieving, there's joyful things. So I'm called in on the heels of some of these life events and to help someone use their physical space and make it pleasing to them in the wake of whatever that change
yes.
has been is really, really rewarding to me. And I know from the feedback I get, people say, well, this has just changed the way I feel about everything. Or I've shucked off all this junk I've been storing, and I've cleared out and lightened up, and I feel different. And, you know, so I get that response often
yeah.
enough to know that, yeah, it's making a difference
yeah.
for people.
It's so interesting. I mean, listening to Annette when we were speaking to her before,
yeah.
there's so many different ways to make the world a better place and to make a difference. And it's great to hear these wildly contrasting ways.
Yeah.
And yet it does have an impact in different and important ways on people's lives.
Well, I'll tell you my philosophy on this. And there was a time, you know, earlier in my career where I thought, God, you know, there's people living in tents after an earthquake, let's say. I mean, you read, I was in the paper, so I was always reading the paper.
Yes.
Front page, you know, refugee camps, people marching to Kenya on bare feet, you know, and on and on, and you can't ignore that. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, for the cost of this one sofa that one of my clients is having, you know, what could be different for those people? So I had to kind of reconcile that I was not out there saving the world in the sort of traditional médecin sans frontières kind of way. I was not being that person or, you know, finding the cure for cancer. But what I do believe, and this has come to be a very strong philosophy for me, is that each house is sort of the container or the cradle for each family.
Yes.
And what happens in your family, you know, do you have dinner together? Do you sit and talk to each other? Do you read together? Do you read to your kids before they go to bed? Are they allowed to drink their milk in the family room in front of TV, or is it all, you know, back in the kitchen? You know, how you run your household creates your family, and it all happens within this crucible that is the house. And making the house compatible and authentic for the family can only be a good thing. But when you collect up all the houses on your street and all the streets in your neighborhood and all the neighborhoods in your town, the house is like the base unit of our society. Our
yes.
whole culture is actually being formed by family 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 doing what they do within their little area of influence, which is their house.
Yes.
And how they run their lives in there actually forms and creates the culture.
Yes. Now take us back in time, Toby. How did you get into this? What did you do after high school?
After high school, I fell in love and did what I guess a few people were doing then, sort of ran off to Vancouver Island and lived on love and fresh air for a while and baked bread and wore my skirts down to the ground and ponytails. So there was a phase there of living on savings for a while and then realizing, okay, I got to work. You know, I'm not happy when I'm not working. And I had a whole string of jobs. Usually, you know, we'd move here, we'd move there, pick up a job, and I could always type and take shorthand on my mother's wonderful advice. My 89-year-old mother always said, honey, if you can do that, you can always get a job anywhere.
Yes.
She was so right. I mean, those skills are no longer really even, they're just so obsolete now, it's funny to even think of them, but that was a ticket to any kind, any number of places. You could work for the prime minister if you had, you know, typing and shorthand. But anyway, I found that I worked in a whole lot of different places, and it was only looking back that I was able to see that they sort of were like the pearls in a necklace. They all added up to something. As I was foraging around thinking, what do I want to be when I grow up and so on, eventually realized I want to go back to school. I'd done a year of university, which was sort of a like grade 14. You know, I just kind of went on from high school not really knowing why I was there, but that is where I met.
So those, those pearls in a necklace that you just mentioned, these were a number of different kinds of jobs. Did they have something to do with design?
They did. Yeah? I didn't see it going forward. I saw it looking backward. I listed them this morning. I worked in the college in Ottawa, the Algonquin College, which taught visual and creative arts. It taught the design school.
Yes.
So I worked as a secretary in the office there, and then I worked in a general contractor's office, you know, when people would call, there's subtrades calling in all their bids for contracts and so on, and I handled that. And then I went into the city of Victoria, where I worked and I began to understand the council and committee systems of a city operation and understood some of the urban renewal projects that were just being born then. This is the 70s. Then I managed a little retail store. Then I worked in the head office of McDonald's restaurants for Western Canada, and I was in it, coincidentally, as luck would have it for me, I was in the department that handled the renovation and construction of new restaurants from Winnipeg out to the coast. Then I worked in the city of London, Ontario, and that was in engineering, and that's when I sort of crossed over from the secretarial into the work of the department, and I became an engineering aide. Learned some drafting, took some courses at Western, rode my bicycle up on my lunch hour to take the drafting course.
Yes.
And then was working on the approvals for subdivisions and new developments in the City of London. So the design approvals for streets and sewers and streetlights and parkland and, you know, how many parking spots does this restaurant need and what should be the access for this drive-through. And so sort of urban development. And from that job, I launched myself back into school at Fanshawe and finally knew that it was not city design but the individual houses that really turned my crank.
Hmm. So how long did that take, Toby, to get to the point where you actually made a conscious choice to go back and do that program at Fanshawe?
My husband and I had a deal. He was going to go to school and I would work, and when he was finished, I would go to school and he would work to support us. And so as he entered school in photography at Fanshawe as well, I was working at the City of London doing this engineering business, and I knew I needed to make my mind up about what I was going to study real soon because he was going to be out in 3 years. And I really bore down on the decision-making, and it was somewhere in there I felt like I sort of a magic wand hit my brain and said, oh, that's it. Then I remembered that as a kid living at home in my parents' house, I had rearranged my bedroom every Saturday of my life the whole time I lived with my parents. I would lie on the floor and look at the ceiling and picture putting the furniture up on the ceiling in different ways. And then that was sort of the first pearl in the chain, and I realized, oh, but that job and that job and that job and that job all lead me right here. Duh.
Yeah,
I get it. You know,
that's so interesting. Thanks
for saying that. I was 26 at that point. And so yeah. I went into first year university at 17. I was fast tracked. And then, so at 26, 9 years later, I had lived in the West Coast, lived back in Ontario, been here, been there. And finally got my act together and entered school as a mature student with girls who were then 17 and 18.
That's so interesting, too, the process of choosing and then choosing your post-secondary education through life experiences, through mm-hmm. a number of jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, I love that metaphor of pearls in a necklace. And I think it's so apt for people who are trying to figure out, what am I going to do next? And, you know, you just don't know.
It's so stressful. You know, you're killing yourself over it. And I think what I maybe did is I relaxed a bit. I stopped stressing about it. And I think I may have even dreamed about it in my sleep. Wait a minute. And as soon as interior design landed in my brain, there was a fantastic school in the town I lived in. B, I was working with streets and sidewalks and houses already. I got that. I was working with drawings and drafting. And it was just a change of scale. It was from, you know, the level of the drawings show a whole neighborhood to the drawings show the inside of an individual house.
So it was like there was a number of clues there that you had followed. And then this intuition, Annette in the earlier interview had talked about tuning into those intuitions and gut feelings. And yeah. It sounds like you had one of those. It took you 6 or 8 years there to for that to develop. But when it developed, then you were probably, can you say, once you went to college, you being the 26-year-old mature student with all these other younger students, how were you a different student than them?
Oh, boy. Well, it's an enormously fertile time of your life between 18 and 26. A lot of maturity, a lot of growing. And I had been places. I had gotten married. I had helped put my husband through school. Lots of life experience. And then I felt like, oh, my gosh, I'm so far behind here. I wanted to be out working. Once I figured out what I wanted to do, it was like, oh, can we get this school done real fast? Can I just get in there and get what I need? And so I was sitting at the front row of every class, and I was really aggravated when people were farting around and giggling behind me. But a lot of those girls were they were in grade 14, you know.
Yes.
Their parents had sent them, and they didn't know what else to do, or they thought it was going to be glamorous. Uh-uh. You know, so I found that I was extremely motivated. I didn't skip school. I didn't go to the pub. Plus, I was maintaining a marriage at the same time, and my husband, the week I started my schooling, and he had graduated the spring before, he called and said, yay, I got a job. Bad news, it's in Hamilton. So I stayed on in London and kept on going to school, and he moved to Hamilton, and we had a long-distance relationship for the 3 years. So that definitely set me apart from the girls in my class. I would go to school at 9 in the morning, come home at 9 at night in order to be free on the weekend to drive home to Hamilton and have, you know, the other half of my life be available to me. So very different. And I did find, too, that and this comes back to the communication skills. A lot of the girls could not get what the teachers were saying. And the teachers sometimes couldn't get what the kids were saying. And I was sort of that middle person. So I would explain one side to the other all the time. They'd be handing out an assignment and saying what was required. And I would be the one to say, this is what she wants from you. This is what they're trying to get from you. Or the kids would have questions and complaints, and I would say to the teachers, this is what they're trying to tell you. So I was very much a middleman, in the equation of the classroom.
Yeah, and you make a strong case for waiting before choosing your post-secondary. I know if listeners aren't feeling as if they're one of those extremely motivated students the way you describe yourself, how valuable life experience is. It was true in Annette's story too earlier that some of her experience really brought her into much more focus, I guess, when you're pursuing.
I gave up a really nice salary. And there are people still working at City of London who were my coworkers. They're still there. And they say, oh, you're so lucky you got out. And I say, no, I wasn't lucky. I gave up a huge salary, all kinds of benefits. I got into debt, student loans, and lived poor and lived apart from my husband for 3 years. I mean, to do all of that and then not be a motivated student would have been like monumentally dumb.
Yes.
Then coming out of that at 29, pushing 30, it's like, but I want children. So here I finally, I'm out of the gate. I'm out of the barn. I can run with the career. But wait a second, I got a biological clock too. And so very soon after at 32, had our first, and then a couple years later, our second daughters. And of course, they're one of them's at Fansaw now herself at 19.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And I would have to say design has been a very accommodating profession for someone who wants to have children. And I remember a teacher saying that to me at the time. It's something that you can work around
your life.
Career and your life.
Yes.
can be together. And then writing for the newspaper for the 20-some years that I've done that, the writing was very compatible with having children. I could be in my jammies at 11 o'clock at night typing on my old IBM Selectric in the early days. And later on a computer, about stuff that was happening in my day job. I might work 2 or 3 days a week and have clients. Well, those client stories would feed into the columns I would write. But column writing was something I could do from home.
Yes.
It could be there. So that was, you know, compatible.
Well, we're talking to Toby Yell here on Career Buzz. She's an interior designer. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. So, Toby, when you graduated, did you come up with the idea of starting your own firm immediately? Is that how it unfolded?
No, I took a couple of jobs and was very dissatisfied. You don't very often see interior designer wanted in the newspaper.
Yes.
And I scanned the ads, and got hired by a couple of different places where basically they wanted a salesperson. A lot of stores will call their staff interior designers or decorators or design consultants, because that makes the customers feel
because it sounds good.
Something great, yeah. But for someone who had just done 3 hard, intense years of school, I didn't want to go and be selling office furniture or selling whatever. And such wonderful coincidence and chance and opportunity, I fell into a gift, which was the home builders in Hamilton were putting on a home show. I called one of them to suggest to him that he needed me in his operation to help his buyers with their selections with new homes. And he said, well, that's a great idea, but just right now we're in a crisis. We've got this home show going. We have these empty booths, and it doesn't look good. Can we give you 4 empty booths, and can you fill them with, make them look like rooms?
Yes.
Drawing on the other exhibitors who were in the show, which was Eaton's and Patterson's and all these lovely purveyors of rugs and furniture and flooring and stuff, accessories and art. And I said, well, could I? These booths were renting for $1,000 a piece, and they were giving me 4 and asking me, could I help them? So I decorated 4 different rooms and quickly printed some cards, and bam, I was in business. The phone started ringing. And I have clients today who phoned me then in 1985.
So again, it was one of those opportunities where luck and preparedness cross over.
I was born lucky, and yeah. I got to say, that little moment was, the sun was shining directly in my face at that moment.
Now, we just have a couple of minutes. It's amazing how time flies when we're talking about these things. You also had this this gig writing for the Hamilton Spectator. How did that come about?
My husband is a Spectator photographer.
Okay, so you had a connection.
Yep, and back in the day, whenever I started, I think it was about 1990, that's what you said in the intro, I would go to the Christmas party or this or that, and I remember just yakking with the guys in the real estate part of the paper, and they said, hey, we could use something. Can you give us something once a week? And I was like, could I? It just flows out of me, right? And it was $25 at that time for
per column.
About 600 words, yeah. But I was thrilled, and I never had to advertise, and it brought in a lot of clientele, and it gave me a little profile, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm still, I'll go in the grocery store, and people say, oh, hi, as if they know me.
Yes, yes. Now, there's so many more things that have gone on in your career, but you sound like you've made some choices that have been sustaining you. You sound happy about them. What, same question that I asked Annette earlier, Toby, what have you learned about making career choices?
Well, I guess just to realize how open-ended it is, because
yes.
I see myself going through another change now. I mean, I worked in urban renewal at the City of Victoria in 1974. Well, urban design is my sort of second track. I think of it as both sides now.
Yes.
Joni Mitchell. I had 2 tracks, writing and interior design. Now I see I have interior. The writing is on vacation for the moment. I have interior design going great guns, seeing my clients, building my practice. But I see urban design is just calling me and calling me, make our whole city better, make our whole country better. So I realize there's no end. It's not over.
Yes.
It's a long road, and just be flexible and don't get so attached to things staying the way they've been and being the way they are. Be ready when life starts calling and you get a little whisper in your ear and then you get it again.
Great,
and get it again.
Great advice.
Don't ignore it.
Toby, if people want to find out more, do you have a website or an email address?
I have an email address, and it's my name, Toby.
Yeah.
Dot Yull,